You know, long, long, long before I started collecting antiquities, I became obsessed in my late teens with the remarkable creativity in our region. I was overwhelmed by the fecundity, for example, up and down the Sepik River of PNG, and by the miraculous sort of variations on themes that you found, say, in the Trobriand Islands. But from day one, I was absolutely fascinated by the Tiwi Islands, the two largest islands being Bathurst and Melville, just off Darwin. And they're justly famous for a couple of things. First, a very strong sense of identity. We are Tiwi, an identity which at the same time is part of the indigenous mainland of Australia, but separate. And the other key characteristic of the Tiwi is an extraordinary range of artistic output. They were painting and crafting their distinctive funeral wooden poles long, long before white contact. But over the past 40 years, their creations have extended to truly stunning printmaking and pottery and fabric designs and many, many types of painting held in collections around the world. And Jennifer Isaacs, Jenny, has played a role in this over the past 40 years with annual visits, initially as the Australia Council's first ever Aboriginal Arts Research Officer. And that's when our paths first crossed, wasn't it, Jenny, all those years ago?
Philip. Yes.
And now Jenny has written, well, it's not a book, it is a magnificent treatise packed with art and photographs called Tiwi, Art, History, Culture, absolutely, emphatically, a life's work. And Jenny, I'm going to start our conversation by giving you the highest award I can endow on a guest, and that is you hereby the winner of a koala stamp.
Thank you, Philip.
You're in our Melbourne studio, where I think you're hosting some Tiwi visitors.
Yes, they just arrived tonight. Unfortunately, they were a bit too tired to come into the studio.
They would have been a bit squashed. Now, why is art making so much the central hub of activity on these islands, Jenny?
Well, it's just that every single person does it, and it sort of goes right back to childhood, to ceremonial life when everybody painted the bodies. And even before that, as I found out some wonderful old photographs, it used to be the body was decorated by cicatrices, the cuts into the skin in these beautiful sort of leaf frond patterns that the earliest ethnographers called the zamiad or the cycad designs. They didn't realise they were actually imitating the barbs of their fabulous multi-pronged spears that are unique in this region. And I think that that's really where it sort of initiated, that everybody wanted to make patterns and marks to signify who they were and which family they belonged to, and it just continued on. They were the very first community, Indigenous community in Australia, to also move into the new age world of contemporary craft and fabric back 40 years ago. And although not, I'm amazed how few people have really understood they are different and that they are one of a very important regional culture in Australia. And when you look at it, the whole continent is a bit like Southeast Asia. Everywhere you move over a large tract of land, you're then entering into another country, in a sense.
Another language grouping and as you point out, the variations on themes are infinitely complex.
Yes, and the other thing you might be interested in is that not only did they enter the tactile arts first, but they were also, unbelievably, I found the photographs, in 1963 they were the first Aboriginal dancers to come to Melbourne and Sydney and performed at the Palais Theatre St Kilda and the Her Majesty's in Sydney. And, oh, the catalogue for that performance, it was absolutely, the language was incredible. They were builders, almost like African primitive savages, you know, that thrilled to the throb of Arnhem Land, this sort of thing. And I thought, my God, that 1963 is 3 years after the art gallery in Sydney, Tony Tuckson, the famous artist, as we know, the abstract painter, who was the deputy director at that period, had gone up to the Tiwi Islands and collected the most fabulous Pukamani poles that are still the central installation of the Aboriginal presence there. And yet, 3 years later, in Melbourne, they were builders. You know what? It was just extraordinary.
So is the body art still maintained, Jenny? Are people still doing the what are effectively tattoos?
Not the scarification, but the painting on the body certainly is done, I would say, really less elaborate than the illustrations that you see in the book. That some of the marvellous things I found were included Tiwi's own illustrations of their own body art, which they did in 1953 for Charles Mountford, who came up there from the South Australian Museum. But today, I'm afraid that, the modern world is taking over to a large extent, and although the Pukamani funeral ceremony is very important, it's certainly nothing like it, what it was in the 70s, really.
One of the things about work particularly involving wood throughout the region is it doesn't last very long because of the, the nature of the temperature. And things of any great antiquity are pretty rare, aren't they?
Oh, yes. I mean, the poles themselves are left in nature to just be eaten by termites if they're softwood, but basically rot in the tropical wet season over time, and there are sort of marvellous skeletal forms all through the forests of the poles as they rot. And for a while there, I think it was probably the 80s and a little of the early 1990s, art institutions didn't quite know what to do about, the postmodern attitude to being authentic in relation to Indigenous cultures and exhibiting them in art contexts. And so they thought, well, if this was designed by the maker to rot in the jungle, then perhaps we should let it rot too. So you had the National Gallery in Canberra and the Darwin Museum both setting up their installations outside, and of course neither of them now exist. But it was a wonderful thing to watch, particularly in Canberra, where they were near a fog sculpture in a cafe that had great cake. I used to go and sit there and watch the fog wafting through the Pukamani poles. Yeah. And they all sort of started looking eroded and fell down and finally were removed. But it was
beautiful. In what is now PNG, it wasn't simply the natural process of rot that destroyed a lot of stuff. It was also the impact of the missions. I remember it was not uncommon for, I think they were called Tamboran houses, like soaring Gothic buildings in the jungles to be burnt down. Yes, did that happen to the Tiwi people?
Not really. I'd have to say that Bathurst Island, because of the Catholic mission that was set up there starting in 1911, 1912, certainly the ceremonies were discouraged, that because in the, I do describe a particular funeral in the book of the first person, Kado Kerenawa, who invented figurative sculpture amongst the Tiwis. And his funeral was quite spectacularly documented by a lovely man, John Morris, who was a missionary, or really a lay missionary at the time in about 1963 or 4. Where the combination of making figures and the death of her husband, she gave expression to it in the sense of sort of cuddling and holding and almost lovemaking to the sculptures that were left in the house. And I think this sort of aspect of Aboriginal ceremony all throughout the missions in Australia was one that sort of alarmed people a bit.
You also record an interesting degree of what I suppose might be loosely described as hybridisation. Now, I remember that while there was an ancient tradition of carving, intricate and small and beautiful carvings from ivory or whalebone with the Inuit, it was outside influences which caused that explosion of really fantastic soapstone carving. And similarly, it seems from your book that white fellas coming in, like, say, the buffalo hunter Joe Cooper or the artist Margaret Preston, that kindled new sort of activities.
Oh, yes. And, in fact, Canada led the way for Australia in lots of ways, because the Bishop of Darwin, Catholic Bishop of Darwin at the time, I first took up my job at the Australia Council in 1970, was a fan of the Inuit carvings and the new prints that were just emerging from Canada, and specifically advertised for someone to come to the Tiwi Islands and introduce printmaking, and that's really what kicked off the contemporary movement there. And you mentioned Joe Cooper, well, the Buffalo era on Melville Island, which is the larger of the two, was, you know, very influential, but also very devastating, I would suspect, for some Tiwi families, because of course, you have to have guns to shoot buffalo, so quite a large group of mainland Aboriginal men were imported by the white buffalo hunters onto Melville Island, and they basically marauded through the Tiwi Islands and assembled quite a harem. And I was utterly dumbfounded one day when I saw some early plate glass negatives of photographs taken by a German ethnographer who went to the islands or sailed there to stay with the buffalo camp, and he'd photographed these extraordinary groups of Tiwi mixing with the mainland people at the time. So that was a big influence.
Well, decades later, Margaret Preston's arrival was probably less traumatic.
Yes, but look at the effect it had on the rest of Australian art. It was fantastic.
Well, tell the listener about Margaret Preston and going to Bathurst in, what, 1940?
Yes, well, you know, she was for a long period an absolute champion of Australianising Australian art and using Indigenous influences, colour, form, geometric language, pattern, in her still life paintings. And she was a sort of stalwart of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and really, when you look at what she, really the earliest ones, have very, very strong, almost you'd say that she just commandeered Tiwi art and made it her own. And so when
this leads to a paradox. On the one hand, it becomes obvious that almost every member of the Tiwi community can contribute, can be involved in art making, but at the same time, stars emerge, don't they? Like, say, Kitty Cantilla.
Oh yes. Well, you've jumped right through to really the explosion that happened after the beginnings, where the art centres were developed. First of all, on Bathurst Island, and then more recently on Melville Island, two wonderful centres there, Moonapie and Gillamara, and the emergence of individuals, because after the governments sort of pulled out a bit in the late 80s, you had the galleries, the private galleries, with a really good eye on looking for the star that they could move into their stable, combing Aboriginal communities, and some in particular just fell in love with the Tiwi because it looks so different. I'm not sure people really catch on to the fact that it does not look like any other form of Aboriginal art. It's its own self, ochre, texture, natural materials, and very, very strong forms and patterns and spaces and deep brown ochre, muddy white pigment. And Kitty Cantilla emerged as really the star, and she's to this day the only Tiwi, or actually the only Aboriginal artist, apart from Clifford Possum, who's actually had a retrospective, and that was at the gallery in Melbourne. And this year, quite a sensational Tiwi year, I have to say, modestly, because it culminated with a win by Timothy Cook, a wonderful, wonderful spiritual painter from Gillamara, for the Telstra Aboriginal Art Award. That's the National Aboriginal Art Award held in Darwin every year. And that tells you who's the best artist in Australia at that given moment.
This is Ellie Noel on RN. It's our last live week. And my guest is Jenny Isaacs, art consultant, curator, a highly regarded long-term champion of Aboriginal art and culture. And she's produced the winner of the Koala Stamp. a book called Tiwi, Art, History, Culture from Magunya Press. What can an art lover see if they visit the Tiwi Islands? You know, is art all around them, or is it in the buildings where it's processed or manufactured?
Oh, people make things at home, but that most of it that's purchasable, I would say, is made in the. There are actually four art centres. There are three that are sort of supported as art centres through art funding processes from the government. And there's another one that I absolutely love, Narawanajiri, which is funded through federal money, through the health system for people with a disability. But it might simply be a crook leg. You know, they're certainly absolutely right out there with the best of art. And that's in a building that we actually funded in the 1970s to be a museum, but it didn't last as that. And it's called the Sistine Chapel of the Tiwi Islands, the entire vaulted curved ceiling, which is very high and curved almost from the ground in a great big arc above the artists' heads, is painted from one end to the other, and there's about 30 artists sitting in there happily painting and eating pies and listening to blues and all sorts of stuff.
I'm now impelled to ask you to tell a bit of your story. I know of you, of course, because our paths crossed in 1970 at a time when Nugget Coombs and our mutual friend Gene Battersby and I had the great joy of being on the newly founded Australia Council. You were the very first Aboriginal arts research officer. Eyebrows must have been raised.
Well, I could still remember you and Barry Jones walking down the corridor and looking in my door and laughing yourself silly, saying, "This is the Aboriginal section." And it wasn't as ironic as you think. I mean, it was hard being a very young white woman at that time in the field, but I made very close friends that I've kept forever. And it's now, 40 years that I've been involved deeply in the Aboriginal world.
And you've seen you've seen not simply evolution, but of course revolution. Has it all been good for the community, or has there perhaps been a dark side to the moon?
When you say all, what do you?
Well, often with the sort of cultural energising that takes place in Aboriginal communities, there has been a degree of exploitation.
Well, I don't think that's happened. I would say that that might be true in the desert, but I don't think it's happened amongst the Tiwi because they are really relatively sheltered from that type of what we used to call carpet-bagging behaviour by opportunistic dealers and that sort of thing. Is that what you...
Yes, I was sort of hinting at in my very diplomatic fashion.
Well, yes, and they're very loyal to their own community, like... Not many Tiwi live south of Darwin. It's just that the connection to country and land is extremely strong, and they just love those islands and love being there and living in it.
Well, we've talked about how outside influences came in, but also you record how influences are being brought in. Now by the Kiwi people. AFL footballers have been incorporated in
Tiwi sculptors, aren't they?
Yes. And the Australian Museum featured a variety of footy man figures in an exhibition.
Yes. That's right. Well, it's a marvellous conjunction because one of the main myths on the Tiwi, when I say myth, it's a true creation story, is the myth of Purukapali, the first man to die. He introduced death to the Tiwi. And it came about because his brother, the moon, Tapara, and I should say that in most Indigenous societies in Australia, brothers are allowed to have the same wife, you know, so, and sisters can have the same husband. So anyway, Purukapali's wife... ran off into the bush with Tapara, the brother, and made love to him. But in the process, her baby, Purukapali's son was left in the sun too long and died. So grief-stricken, Purukapali and Tapara fought, and the Tapara, the moon, then rose up into the sky. Purukapali lifted his dead baby son and walked backwards into the sea, holding him above his head. Now, the image, the sculpted image of Purukapali holding a baby above his head became a Pukamani pole with a round dome on top.
What a story.
And has merged into, I haven't finished, the footy man. So you've got this sort of central image, almost as important to Tiwi as the crucifix.
With the upraised merging arms, into the, yes.
Merging into the AFL symbol of a triumph.
Yeah. And you also tell about Jock Poit Jimmy, who makes small poles out of kiln-cast crystal, for heaven's sake.
Yes.
So wood, you know, is still the primary material, but crystal?
Well, he does do it away from the Tiwi Islands. He works in with glass artists elsewhere. There's a lot of movement these days into public art and that sort of thing. So they're really, you know, out there with the best of artists. And those glass Pukamani poles are just beautiful.
Tell us about Janice Murray and her idiosyncratic birds, as you describe them.
Well, she seems to paint almost nothing else. She just loves those great big fat beaky birds. And there's some wonderful ones she's done. I couldn't fit the... there's 800 photographs in the book, so there's a lot I've left out as well. And what she does for a group called Urban Art Projects in Brisbane are exactly those birds that you see illustrated in the book as painted works in aluminium, cast aluminium, and they're pretty gorgeous.
Well, so are you. So are you, Jennifer Isaacs.
Thank you, Philip.
And the books,
very sweet.
Absolutely fantastic.
Especially as you can't see me.
No, but I remember you well. You remember we were together not so long ago at a rather sad occasion.
Yes.
Jennifer Isaacs is the author of Tiwi Art History Culture. It's a terrific offering from Magunya Press, which, of course, is part of MUP. Thank you, Jenny. If you're in Melbourne and you want a bit more of this, a couple of options. The official launch of the book is Tuesday night. That's tomorrow night at the Vivian Anderson Gallery in Caulfield. My old comrade from Australia Council days, Rodney Hall, is doing the honours. 100 tickets gone already, but they might be able to squeeze in a few more. On Wednesday night, there's an event at Eltham at the Montserrat Artist Centre, of which I remain an ancient trustee. Costs $15 to get in. Jenny will show lots of images, and the Tiwi artists who are visiting will be talking, and that's being run by, good on ya, the Eltham Bookshop. Now, on our next... Well, it'll be farewell for the year to Bruce Shapiro, the latest on Putin, and Power in the Empire. I'll be talking to Pamela Hicks, who is, in fact, Lord Louis Mountbatten's daughter, the daughter of Louis and Edwina, and what she doesn't know about what went on at the upper echelons of English aristocracy isn't worth talking about. But she does. She talks about it all. She's remarkably candid in the book, and I'm looking forward to meeting her. Stick around now for the news, and Elena Katz-Chernin will take us out.